Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome all of you, but we have special greetings to some students in a coalition. So, would the Abbotsford High School students please stand? It's good to have you here. You may be seated. Would the Horning Middle School students please stand? It's good to see you all, and you may be seated. We have the Coalition on Aging. Would the coalition members please stand?
Big group.
Oh, big group. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with our program, which is called Court with Class. And for several years, we have invited students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. And if the students accept the invitation, they come to oral argument. But first, we send them the briefs, and they may engage in some activities related to the case that they're about to hear. And then, as part of the program, the students meet with a justice of this court and discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues that are involved in the case. Everyone, and that includes members of the coalition, and others in the audience are invited to join the students with the justice right after this case, probably around noon. The justice with whom you will meet today is, and let me introduce him, on my far left, Justice Lewis Butler. And let me introduce the other members of the court. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right is Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Robensack. Anyone who would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, if you'd raise your hand, we can give you a brief summary of the case. It's easier to listen to oral argument if you have a summary of the case in terms of the facts and the law. So if you would like a summary, just raise your hand. Okay? You don't get a summary then. We shall now proceed to call our first case. This is 05AP1629, G. Vaughan Stone versus Acuity, is it Acuity Insurance Company? Arguing on behalf of Acuity, a mutual insurance company, is Arthur P. Simpson. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning. Appearing this morning, we are the defendant, appellant, petitioner, Acuity, appearing by Arthur P. Simpson. With me at council table is Michelle Johnson. We are going to be discussing this morning the various intricacies of two doctrines, the concept of contextual ambiguity, and my belief is we'll probably spend a little more of our time on the notice statute, WISSTAT 632.32, prints 4M, 1, and 2. Before I launch into a discussion of the ins and outs of those concepts, I think the one thing I would like to try and leave the court with today is a focus on just the equities of this situation and why we are here. This is not a case of some outrageous conduct by an insurance company or business. This is not a case where there's some conduct that needs to be punished or deterred. What this is in my mind, a case of gotcha, for lack of a better way to put it. We got you with respect to the statute. We got you with contextual ambiguity. We got you with respect to the stipulation. The ultimate facts in this case, when it comes right down to it, are that the Stones did not buy the insurance coverage at issue, and now they want it after an accident has occurred. They had $300,000 in underinsured motorist coverage since 1993. They had an umbrella without underinsured motorist coverage since 1993. No policy ever changed. No second policy was ever issued. Their original position was they didn't understand the policy because of contextual ambiguity. Then midstream, they indicated, well, we would have bought more coverage if we'd had notice under this notice statute, something that's not in the trial court record and was actually brought up by an effort to supplement the record at the level that this court set. I am a member of a group known as the Insurance Premium Paying Public. My guess is that many members of this court, hopefully all, are a member of that group as well.
Yeah, we're not organized, though. We're not organized.
Not organized officially, but nevertheless, it is an important group. Unfortunately, not organized, because that would be something
Counselor,
that would be a sight to
does
see.
Does it matter with regard to our decision in Ribbonek that there was a separate policy there, and here we're looking at an endorsement to an ongoing policy?
That absolutely matters.
Why?
Because this is the, I want to look at this, number one, from the language of the statute, which I wanted to address specifically. I gave each of you a copy of the statute. The statute talks about one notice for a policy. It doesn't say the term endorsement. And the question is, what's a reasonable business to do? What's a reasonable person to do? I thank God that I was never told that my career would be spent trying to write insurance policies or interpret insurance regulations on the front end, because not even Houdini could figure out what one should or shouldn't do in many circumstances, this certainly being one of them.
Does that mean that you don't aspire to sit on the court?
No, I don't think voters aspire to that either. Well, I understand. That's a very good comment.
Thought of it as you mentioned it.
I think it makes a big difference, because if I'm in the business and I see this statute, what Acuity did is they tried to work with the insurance commissioner. If you look at the record, I believe it's at page 195 of our appendix, there's a page there from Mr. Riso, who's an underwriter with Acuity, attached to his affidavit about what went on here. They try to work with the insurance commissioner to try to do the right thing under the statute. They sent out a notice to everybody back in 1995 with respect to this policy. And if I look at that policy, and it doesn't say anything about endorsements, it says policy is what's in the statute.
Does it say that you can buy underinsured motorist coverage in both your basic policy and in your umbrella coverage? Does the notice say that?
The notice was a general notice that was sent to the insurance commissioner.
What did it
say? Without objection. I'll have to look and see what's in the record about that. Mr. Riso's affidavit indicates the wording is not specific as to the type policy, but explains underinsured motorist coverage.
And how much would
195.
But you don't have the notice in the record?
I don't believe, because this was so long ago, I don't believe he has the specific notice in the record, because that was sent in 95 or 96.
The policy UIM is basic automobile policy, and the
if you look at page 200 of the appendix, that's where the notice actually is. The notice provides.
Counsel, could you stand in front of the mic, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. The notice provides underinsured motorist coverage may be purchased to provide payments to an insured person for bodily injury provided by an accident if the owner or driver of the other vehicle has bodily injury limits less than your underinsured motorist limits. The officer, the insurance commissioner, has asked us to advise you. You do have a right to file a complaint, and gives a notice and contact for the insurance commissioner regarding it. That I didn't read the whole thing word for word, but it's at page 200. Nothing in this statute that says you have to, every time there's a new product that you offer, that you're to provide another notice. In fact, the statute says only one notice need be provided. We'll put up section, let's put up section one of the policy first.
Is there a problem when you gave the notice in 1995 or 695, and you didn't write that type of insurance until 99? There's a 4-year gap. So say I would have wanted the insurance, what does the person do?
Well, for one thing,
I wait until 99 and then ask again?
Get a different insurance company if you don't like it. Okay. Do you want to get more insurance? Talk to your agent.
Yeah, well, I think that an insurance company probably has the, quote, right to offer whatever coverage they want. But under the statute, 632.32, you have to give the notice. So you gave the notice even though you didn't write it. So you don't see any disconnect there? You thought you should give the notice. Should you say that's the notice, but then we are in the process of developing this coverage, or we don't write it at this time, or we don't have it?
Well, I look at the statute and I don't see where it says anything about providing notice when there is a new product that's at issue.
Okay.
The
All
fact
right.
remains that this is the same policy, 93, 99, 2002. It's exactly the same policy. It was in effect as of October 1 of 1995. I believe that would take us out of the applicability of Section 1 here, because it says an insurance policy that goes into effect after October 1 of 1995. The purpose of this statute wasn't to make the carrier guess as to whether an endorsement is a policy, to make the carrier guess as to if they change their coverage, they had to send a different notice. It also indicates in Section 1 that only one notice is required. One notice was sent here. There's no dispute about that. I think those are the two things we need to focus on with respect to the statute, subsection 1. The Court of Appeals never gave an opinion as to exactly which of these two was violated, as I recall the decision. But one notice was given here. There's been one policy since 93, or I guess under the plaintiff's version of this, there have been four policies since 1993, since every endorsement is a separate policy. It's the argument they seem to be making under Section 600.35. No matter how many policies you want to say, there was a notice that was provided. They checked with the insurance commissioner with respect to that notice. What else are they supposed to do with respect to this?
Counsel, what is your response to their argument regarding 600.35?
The statute itself is, let me get it here, says policy means any document other than a group certificate used to prescribe in writing the terms of an insurance contract, including endorsements and riders and service contracts issued by motor clubs. The statute does not say that each endorsement is a separate policy, doesn't say each rider is a separate policy, doesn't say, for example, what the court... It's part of the insurance policy, but that's not the statute says any document other than a group certificate, including endorsements, is an insurance policy. Certainly an endorsement is part of an insurance policy. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you it isn't. But what I'm going to tell you is this isn't four. This policy had three endorsements. Are you telling me this was four insurance policies? I'm sorry.
We're recording.
I know you are, and I better glue my feet down here, among other things. But... this isn't four policies. Even if it is four policies, the fact is, if you take a look at, can you put section two up there? We're down to one easel today, so we're going to be flipping these. I'm sorry. Section two of the statute indicates that a policy that's in effect October 1 of 1995 and does not include underinsured motorist coverage, those are the provisions under which it becomes applicable. In this particular case, the same policy is in effect all along. It's been in effect since 1993, and one notice was provided at that time.
Mr. Sampson, I'm looking at page 140 of your appendix. And this is the, as I understand it, your summary of this policy. Is that right?
What's known as the declarations page.
Okay. That's what the declaration page is, isn't it? It summarizes what coverage you have?
I don't know exactly where. It lists what the coverages are.
Okay.
I don't know.
Let me tell you what my problem is.
Okay.
It states your coverages, and it states Section 1 deals with property. Section 2 deals with liability. Section 3 deals with uninsured and underinsured motorists, but that relates to the basic automobile policy. And then the fourth thing is umbrella. And then it has $1 million there. Had they bought underinsured motorist coverage under the umbrella, my assumption is, only because that's what my policy does, it would have showed under umbrella underinsured motorist limit. Right?
I don't know exactly how they phrase the declarations page when it's added, but continuing on.
Yeah. And the reason it's set up in this way is the recognition the umbrella, whether you call it an endorsement or a policy, is yet a very different set of coverage. And you would have needed, I think under the statute, it's arguable you would have needed to show that you can purchase another underinsured motorist coverage under the umbrella policy. That's the point of this. That's the issue in the case, isn't it?
Well, that's one way of looking at it. The statute, just if you read the statute, it does not say that you need to provide. For example, let me put it this way to you. Let's say Acuity has, in 1999, they make $1 million umbrella available. In 2003, they make $5 million umbrella available because inflation or for whatever business reason they decide to. Do they then have to give a notice in 99, 2004?
I don't know what the statute would say. Does the statute require a new notice if you can up the coverage?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know either. And how's a business supposed to decide
that? But we're dealing with the statute. My another point is, when you buy an umbrella policy, you're required to have auto policy, and you're required to have homeowners, and that they all have to fit together, right?
Depends on the underwriting requirements of the carrier.
Okay, but generally they all fit together because
it's
umbrella covers over and above, and they want you to have the basic policy, or you're self-insured for that basic amount. Okay. Suppose that your company or any company sold auto, umbrella, and homeowners, and anything else. You can figure out another insurance policy, maybe for boats, although that's generally covered under homeowners, and put them all in one policy. You think they'd only have to give one notice on whatever notices are required for each of these policies under the insurance code?
Well, now, wait, how many notices would – well, first of all, how would you have a notice for UIM under a homeowners? I don't know that you have that. Are you talking about notices
but there
in
may
general?
Be something – other notice under homeowners. Does it mean that because you have got them all in one policy, you don't have to give all the notices required? I'm just trying to say that you package – some companies package – personal umbrella like this into one policy and endorsement. Others sell two policies or three. So should the notice be limited on the basis of how you market?
That's a reasonable what you're asking, first of all, and I'm going to walk over here and I'll try not to talk while I'm over here.
Don't say a word. Promise?
What I did as I walked over there was to highlight the word notices to be provided only one time. What the problem that I have with this entire situation is that Acuity provided notice one time. Now, you're saying that when the scope of the product changes, when there's a new coverage added, that triggers a second obligation to provide notice. I think the issue about the policy and the number of policies here, when you really get down to that, again, that's what
what a reasonable reading of the statute yield. We provided a notice. They checked with the insurance commissioner about what they were supposed to do. Now what the court's saying years later is subject to $1 million penalty, you should have provided notice every time you issue a new product. And I don't know how you can say under this set of facts that you need a notice for that $1 million available in 99 without saying every time you add a new product, you're to provide notice.
Another question. Was there a maximum of underinsured motorist coverage that you provide under the automobile policy? Was there a maximum that Acuity would write under underinsured?
Without it being part of the, I do not know the answer to that because that's an underwriting question. I don't know.
But might make a difference if they would only write up to $500,000 under Section 3, but they'd write another $500,000 or $1 million under umbrella.
All I can tell you from that, and I'm not totally comfortable with this, is that I'm trying a case in 3 weeks where the underlying policy is $1 million. And State Farm had $100,000 and then $1 million umbrella, and the issue was because they had that million there, we owe 10/11 of the obligation. Now, that suggests to me maybe they do write that way, but I'm not comfortable representing this to you.
I don't know. I know that in a personal umbrella, you ordinarily have to have a base amount in the underinsured.
I've seen them written both ways, but I'm not comfortable in representing to this court what the underwriting practices are with respect to this issue, because I come back to, I see this as an issue of statutory construction and giving a reasonable reading of the statute. This is not an insurance policy that's to be strictly construed against the carrier or tortured or whatever phrase you might use.
Tortured, no. Strictly construed, yes.
Yeah.
The concept in insurance law is you construe a statute and then construe the policy against the, not the statute, but the policy against the insurance company because they drafted it.
That's exactly right. And there are differences of opinion as to how far that reaches, which are not relevant to our issues today. But this is a statute to be given a reasonable construction, not one to be given a strict construction.
Help me with this. I want to follow up with Justice Wilcox's question. Your argument is that you gave notice in 1995. Is that correct?
The notice was provided at that time.
1995. But you didn't start providing coverage until 1998, 99.
That's correct as well.
Doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to require you to give notice when, if the coverage isn't available.
The answer to that question lies in the purpose of this statute, and that is to give people notice that, hey, we've got this new coverage that's available. You can contact your agent. You can figure out what's covered and what isn't. If you want to get UIM coverage, you can. The statute doesn't say, gee, every time there's a change in the product, there's more coverage available or could be available, you've got to provide notice. You want to educate the public
here.
That's
a long answer to my I thought maybe it was a long question. It doesn't seem to make sense to require an insurance company to give notice regarding the availability of UIM and the personal umbrella if they're not selling it. Doesn't make sense to me. Does it make sense to you?
They are selling, as part of that policy, they're selling UIM coverage, and they did give notice about the UIM coverage back in 1995. What's the difference? The statute says you're to give one notice about this type of coverage. It doesn't say every possible coverage you would have in the future creates a new obligation to give notice. That's where the rubber meets the road with this. If you're going to say that statute, which says one notice and one notice is given, actually means whenever you have a new product, you're supposed to send out a notice about it, that's a whole different set of rules. Well, and if the insurance commissioner wanted that of the legislature, they could have said it.
Then in Rebernick, a couple of times it is written, you know, where available. That's where the statute and interpreting the statute. In other words, the statute means where available notice is required. But you're saying notice is required even if not available? Is that your position?
No.
Well, then I'm missing something from Justice Wilcox.
Yeah, I think there's a disconnect here.
Yeah, because
the statute provides that...
In front of the microphone, please. I'm sorry, Mr.
A policy that's in effect... I should never use any blow-ups because that gets me walking too much. A policy that is in effect on October 1 of 1995, written by an insurer, does not include UIM coverage, written notice of the availability of underinsured motorist coverage, including a brief description. It says under this subdivision, you provide the notice only one time in connection with the first renewal of each policy occurring after 120 days after October 1, 1995. The policy here was in effect October 1 of 1995. The notice was provided one time.
But you didn't offer UIM in 1995.
Where in the statute does it say if there's a change in the product mix that you offer, you're supposed to then...
Sub 1.
You're supposed to then provide a new notice.
And insurer writing the policies. You don't write in... If you have sub 1 there, that's how it starts out. And insurer writing the policies that in... Sure, with respect to motor vehicle. And in Rebernick, in paragraph 25, we said, put another way, the legislature has determined that where UIM coverage is available, insured should know about it.
Well, that was, I guess that was a comment that was in the Rebernick decision. I understand that was there. Whether that How the insurance commissioner's position on all this would affect that, I don't know, but that's a side issue I'll come to.
Okay, come to it.
Now? Okay. I deflected your question and didn't get...
Well, that's how Rebernick interpreted an insurer writing policies in paragraph 25, and then again in paragraph 32. If a policy, an insurer writing such policies must provide to one insured under the policy written notice of the availability. I mean, why would you ever require notice of availability if it wasn't available because you don't write it? That's my problem.
Well, the first question on the statute is whether this endorsement is actually a policy, which we've already talked about in the brief.
Yeah, but an endorsement, I mean, most policies include the endorsements. You're not really making...
You're arguing it. You don't have two policies here. You have one.
Yeah, I mean, endorsements are part of the policy.
Well, there's no question that's true. The endorsement is part of the policy. But I'm not saying it's not a second policy that triggers a duty to give notice here. The statute indicates that you're supposed to, it really comes back, I think, more to the new product issue. When you have a new product.
It comes back to that you have one policy you gave from your perspective. It was the motor vehicle policy. It had an endorsement on umbrella. You gave notice as to underinsured motorist. You think that notice covered both the endorsement on the personal umbrella and covered the motor vehicle. Is that your argument?
Yep. Our policy gave notice to the public and with the approval of the insurance commissioner that there's this product available, you can get what you want with it.
At that time, it was only available for the underlying motor vehicle, but not available for the endorsement umbrella.
That's correct.
When you gave notice, the personal umbrella. And you're saying, good enough, because just because you changed your coverage doesn't change your responsibility under 4M.
And I'm not saying good
enough. It's not a policy.
I'm not saying good enough because it's something to say on a Wednesday morning. The policy says there's only the notice shall be provided only one time. The carrier's led down the path, and now we're saying, well, we really want, when there's a new product, we need a new notice every time.
Well, the product you're talking about is offering the umbrella that would include that. So the product you're talking about is umbrella. You have an umbrella. You did not cover this, and you didn't cover it until 4 years later. So I guess that's what you're taking the position when you say new product. But had you not put out that notice, would you have felt you would have violated 632.32? Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't feel that way because I don't think anyone would look at this document or would look at what happened here and say that that endorsement availability constituted a policy that triggered an obligation for a second notice.
But you had to put out a notice. I guess what we're I'm fumbling with clearly is the fact that you put out a notice that didn't really make any difference because they couldn't have bought it if they wanted to.
No. What you're,
well, what you're saying is that yes, they could have gone to another insurance company. They had that opportunity because if I wanted to be covered for when you read the declaration page, if I thought I had $1 million in underinsured motorist coverage, the point is I wouldn't get it from Acuity. I would have had to go to some other company. That's all I'm saying. So Acuity, at the time they put out the notice, the customer couldn't have done anything anyway with Acuity. He could have done it, he or she could have done it with somebody else, but they couldn't have done it with Acuity.
Sure, the policy of the statute would have been served. The customers told, hey, there's this new product out there. When this first came out, I think it was in the mid-1980s, it was a new product. As I recall, the first notice decision was about 1985, so early 1980s is when this product first came out. And what the legislature decided to do was underinsured motorist coverage, we're going to make that mandatory on the policy, which is what they've done. That's uninsured. With underinsured motorist coverage, however, they said, well, let's let people know that it exists and let people make the decisions for themselves. They didn't say every time there's a new product, you've got to give another notice. And that's the way that's the way the plaintiff is asking this that the statute be construed.
Mr. Simpson,
Justice Butler.
Taking your argument to its logical conclusion, under sub 2, why did you give notice at all?
Why not? It's a marketing device. What could be greater than to tell people, let's get some more insurance?
The statute says, as I understand your argument, the statute applies under sub 2 where the policy does not include underinsured motorist coverage. And as I understand your position, your policy included underinsured motorist coverage with respect to the stumps. So if I'm following your argument correctly, your position is you never needed to send a notice at all. Is that correct?
As a lawyer reading that statute, that's probably that's correct. As a businessman, knowing the environment in this state, I would have said to insurance, let's send another notice. That way we're complying with a statute that says one notice. Why mess around with it and take a chance that 11 years later we'll be in this room? Number one. Number two, I'd say
that you can sell more product.
More than that, I'd say, I love this. This is an official chance for me to send out a notice to sell more insurance. That's why it's so puzzling to me that this is, that there's a punitive aspect that's being applied to this statute. I'm sure the legislature thought, well, all this is a reminder to tell them, let's send out more notices, and they'll be thrilled to do it. And they were thrilled to do it. That's what they did in this case.
See, I'm puzzled by the fact that you say as a business person you could send this out and you'd sell more insurance. But you couldn't because you didn't offer the product. This is like saying you're going to add on, you're selling them, stick with insurance. I was going to add something on to an automobile, but you couldn't. So there was no advantage for you to send it up.
Well, I could have raised the UM, and again, this is where I'm a little on shaky ground, but I could have raised my UIM limit from 300 to 500 on this policy, sold more insurance that way. I'm sure if there had been a groundswell of we want more UIM, as they ultimately did, they came out with a new product
that's
on it.
True. That you could have raised your underlying insurance, but you, as far as the umbrella is concerned, you couldn't have done anything because you didn't offer it.
Let's put it this way. I don't think sending this notice out was going to be happy days, we're going to get all this new premium and cases in, because people send these notices by the bucket full. I get three every day in the mail, and I doubt most people do anything but throw them away immediately. But the bottom line was, why take a chance on this? The statute says one notice. They ran it by the insurance commissioner. That's the only thing they can do. I don't know if they could get a declaratory judgment action started at that point. Why take a chance? Let's do this. It says one notice. We sent one notice. The public knows about UIM coverage. If they want to go to another carrier and we start losing business, Maybe we'll get our, maybe we'll add that product earlier. If we don't lose business, maybe we'll pick up a little bit, but at least we'll be in compliance with the statute, and 11 years later, we won't be standing in the Supreme Court in the situation we happen to be standing in right now. That would be my way of addressing that particular point.
Justice Prosser.
Could I ask a question? If I had an automobile insurance policy with no umbrella coverage, and then I spoke to Justice Bradley, she said, you really ought to get umbrella coverage. And so I said, I want $1 million umbrella coverage. Is someone, how am I going to know, or any consumer going to know, that the umbrella coverage could have underinsured motorist coverage?
Talk to your independent agent who sells that to you. That's what agents do for a living, is they explain those coverages, and they say, boy, I think you need this, and you should have it, and they place it. And if they're not placing it with Acuity, that's Acuity's hard cheese as far as that goes. But that's the way the world works. You talk to your agent about that. I don't know how else I can put that. This notice, this statute didn't say, give us a, you know, send us a proposed declaration sheet. Send us a proposal of what might be covered. Send us notice every time there's a new product offered. None of that's in the statute. The question is, what does the statute say? Now, in terms of what your hypothetical, which I hope it wasn't reflecting your driving that Justice Bradley said that, but your car when she said that. But at any rate, you talk to your agent, and that's the way it's been. That's the way insurance has been sold as long as there's been insurance.
Was there some deficiency on the part of the Stones agent here?
I have no ideas of the conversations they had with their agent. I do know this, that these folks have made a decision like every consumer that I know makes every day of their lives. You go in and you decide to buy a car, you decide to buy insurance, you decide to buy groceries. They made the decision, we're going to have 300,000 of this UIM coverage, and then they didn't get any further insurance with respect to that. Now, I think, and I was chastised by Judge Fine for saying this, but I think it's difficult to say, gee, I didn't understand this, I didn't know about insurance, when you have $300,000 in UIM coverage. Maybe I'm wrong. But this is not a case where they're coming in saying, well, we never heard of this coverage. They knew they had it. In addition to that, they got a notice under this statute, and for all that, they decide to buy $300,000 insurance. And there's nothing wrong with saying, just like everybody else in the insurance premium public, that's what you ought to have because that's what you paid for. That's what my contract says, and that's what everybody should have to live with. That is what they bought, not free insurance, or not insurance with a premium after the accident.
If I may interject, your red light has been on. We've been asking you a lot of questions.
I'm sorry.
When you come back, you're going to have to talk about Reformation.
Contextual ambiguity?
Reformation.
Reformation.
Once you know what your remedy is, if you lose.
Oh, I am sorry. I understand. I'm sorry. I had this book over the red light. Sorry.
It's all right.
We knew it was what the color was. Questions were asked anyway. This is, I'm trying to find my sheet so I can properly introduce you, counsel. Got it. Thomas J. Lonzo of Cook and Frankie, representing the Stones. Counsel.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, I am Tom Lonzo. I represent the plaintiffs, respondents, Vaughn and Christine Stone in this case. What I'd like to highlight for the court this morning, and just briefly, is what I would consider and what we would consider are very compelling facts in this case, which sets it somewhat apart from the Rebernek case, but it ties into the Rebernek case, and I'll explain what I mean. Rebernek, as the court well knows, ultimately held that the Rebernecks were not entitled to the UIM umbrella coverage under the facts of that particular case. Our facts are significantly different. And the compelling part of our facts, which I'd like to highlight again, are, as Mr. Simpson just commented, coverage for the Stones began in 1993. At that point in time, they had UIM limits of $300,000, and they purchased an umbrella policy of $1 million. In 1996, as has been referenced in questions to Mr. Simpson, Acuity sent notice to its policyholders about primary policy UIM coverage, including to those policyholders that already had such coverage, such as the Stones in this case. UIM umbrella coverage was not offered by Acuity until 1999, 3 years after they provided that notice. When they did provide this, product or this UIM umbrella coverage in 1999, significantly, Acuity made the decision to advise new policyholders of the availability of this UIM umbrella coverage, not those policyholders such as the Stones who had been paying premiums for the last 6 years in their case, or supposedly others, of the availability of this UIM umbrella coverage. Mr. Rousseau states that in his affidavit, which was...
They get two notices, one under their motor vehicle policy and one under the endorsement.
I'm sorry.
Did they get two notices that underinsured motorist coverage was available? One under their basic car policy, auto policy, and one under their under their umbrella policy.
It is our position that they should, but they didn't in this case.
Well, what about the cases you're telling us? New policies. They did give notice, right? Did they give two notices or one notice? That's what I'm asking.
It's my understanding from reading Mr. Rousseau's affidavit, which was filed in the trial court in this case, page 195 of the appellant's appendix, that they provided notice to new policyholders of the availability of UIM umbrella coverage. And I understood that to also...
What page was that, 195?
You've got two umbrella, two underinsured policies. Mm-hmm. Primary. One under your primary auto policy and one under the umbrella endorsement. No, do you understand what I'm trying to ask?
I'm sorry,
okay.
I do not.
I buy a new policy from Acuity. It is an automobile policy, and it has an endorsement for an umbrella coverage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I am now going to get notice from Acuity relating to my opportunity to buy underinsured motorist coverage, right?
Yes.
Am I told that I can buy one coverage under my basic auto coverage and another under my umbrella, or am I just told that I can buy underinsured motorist coverage, period?
I believe that under this court's holding in Rieberneck that separate notices are required. And I believe specifically in this case, when the separate product was offered 3 years after the first notice was provided.
195 is not the notice for new policyholders in the record.
No, I just meant that that was the page where Mr. Rousseau states what types of notices were provided.
Oh, gotcha.
I'm sorry.
All right.
And by the way, Mr. Simpson was asked during his presentation whether the notice was here, and I think he referenced page 200 as the notice. So I think...
That's the notice to the Stones.
My understanding that that is the primary policy notice, which the question was it didn't differentiate between umbrella and primary policy. I will also point out, if I may, that as I read Mr. Rousseau's affidavit, the memo attached to his affidavit, he states in the middle of the page, this is page 195, unfortunately, I was unable to obtain a copy of the exact renewal notice. So I think that what he is saying here, this is a sample of what it looked like, but it's not the exact one.
Counselor, as I listen to your argument, to me it seems you're talking about how much money does Acuity have to pay.
And so I ask you this question. If when the notice of UIM coverage that was required by the statute was given by Acuity, and they would only write $100,000, and your clients bought $100,000, if under their automobile liability policy they later offered $300,000 as UIM coverage, do they have to send another statutory notice for that increase in amount that they're willing to write for?
I believe so. Why? Well, the statute, as I read it, and as I interpret this court's decision in Rebernick, requires separate notice when UIM coverage becomes available.
But I'm telling you, this is a different hypothetical.
Okay.
You got just a regular policy. Forget the umbrella. And at the time the Acuity gives the notice, they'll only write you $100,000. So your clients get the notice and they call their insurance agent and say, you know, what's available? And he says, well, I can write up to $100,000 of UIM coverage for you. They said, fine, we'll take it. 3 years later, Acuity decides it's been a really good seller and maybe people might like more, so we're gonna begin writing UIM up to $300,000. Same policy, same people. Does Acuity have to give statutory notice again that it's raised the limits for which it will write UIM coverage?
I'm not sure. My off-the-cuff answer to your question is that they probably do not, because the statute.
And how is that different than what we're talking about here? Because what we're really talking about is they got the $300,000 limits under the basic policy, and they've got a rider where now Acuity is going to let them add on. So what's the difference if they added on in the endorsement or they added on in the basic policy?
Because I believe that umbrella coverage is a different animal, and this was discussed in the Rebernick decision. Umbrella coverage is intended to protect someone's possessions. It's intended to protect.
But we're only talking about underinsured motorist coverage. When someone hits me and I have more injuries than their coverage provides for me, or however UIM happens to be defined in the policies, and they do differ somewhat. So we're just talking about one piece of the puzzle here. And to me, it seems like what you folks are arguing over is money. How much does Acuity have to pay? And if the statute has a requirement that you believe every time an insurance company raises its limits for which it'll write liability, and I buy that, I buy your argument. But if it doesn't, you're losing me.
Well, for this particular, I see a distinction,
okay.
With all due respect. I see distinction between someone raising the limits on an underlying policy and an umbrella policy. This court specifically held, as I interpret and read the Rebernick decision, that they're two different animals. And the statute, as interpreted by this court, the plain language as well as the legislative intent, which this court went over in the Rebernick decision, requires the notice with respect to an umbrella policy. And I think it's particularly important under the facts of this case, given the time frame between when the notice was provided and when they made this coverage available. I hope I answered your question.
Can I follow up Justice Rogensack's question? And I'm looking at Appendix 140 of the petitioner's appendix, and I'm looking specifically at the various coverages that are covered. Now, in addition to Section 3 that includes uninsured motorists and underinsured motorist coverage and the umbrella policy, I see here dwelling, Fox Valley Savings and Loan Association, endorsements, coverage enhancements plus, limited fungi, wet and or dry rot or bacteria coverage. Is that, in your view, part of this policy, this dwelling coverage, or is that the same policy that covers this automobile?
Particularly the endorsements?
I'm talking about the dwelling. As I understood Acuity's argument, This is one policy. Now, I'm looking at the declarations on this one policy. And in addition to coverages listed in the first section that we've been talking about, you have dwelling, you have vehicles, you have a Subaru, Forester wagon, a Mercury Cougar, a Chevy S10 pickup, a Dutchman travel trailer, a Jayco pop-up camper that are included. Now, are each of those different coverages one policy, or are those covered, in your view, and I'm going to be asking Mr. Simpson the same question, or are we dealing with different policies for the stones? As I understand what I think Mr. Simpson is saying, this is all one policy. That's how I understand his argument. What's your view?
Well, my view, and this was cited in our brief, that particularly for this umbrella, even though it's called an endorsement, even though it's...
I'm out of the umbrella now. I'm talking about the dwelling. I'm looking at the declarations page. We're talking about the dwelling that's covered on the declarations page. Is that a separate policy than the umbrella? Is that or is the underinsured motorist? Or is some of the other things, the Jayco pop-up camper? Are these separate things, or are they all just Acuity's policy for well-being?
I interpret, including the dwelling part, the statute to say, and I'm referring to section 600.0335, to say that where policy is not defined within the statute, you use 600.0335, which says endorsements are separate policies. So I would say that under that analysis, it is a separate policy. I hope I answered your question. And a point that I want to highlight here with that, if you think of it logically, particularly with this umbrella endorsement, quote-unquote endorsement, it's something that the Stones separately had to pay for. A policy is basically a contract between the insurer and the insured. In exchange for a premium, the insurer provides specific terms, specific coverage. Logically, it's an insurance policy. It's a contract between the insured and the insured. That's what happened in this case. The Stones separately paid a premium for that umbrella. Therefore, from a logical standpoint, not only by virtue of the statute which was just cited, but from a logical standpoint, policy, this umbrella is a policy and has to get the separate notice as required by the statute, as interpreted by this court in the Rebernick case. And also, there was a good point made by one of the amicus parties in one of their briefs. If you do not find that endorsements in this case is a separate policy, what will happen is some insurers who issue separate umbrella policies versus some that may attach it and call it an endorsement, you create a situation where some will have to give the notice and some will not have to give the notice if you find there to be a distinction in that case.
Let me ask you this, Ms. Alonzo. I'm assuming you're here defending the Court of Appeals decision, and I'm assuming you're defending it with respect to the reformation that was done by the Court of Appeals. But as I read the Court of Appeals decision, did it not go a bit far in terms of the issues that would surround reformation? I mean, assuming the court were to agree with you on the underlying Rebernick argument, don't you still have factual questions that are involved in this case as to what, if any, remedy should exist?
Well, I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate your concurrence dissent in the Rebernick case.
Not a concurrence dissent. It was a dissent. I'm not sure why anybody put that label on it. It was a straight dissent.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I saw it.
I know the Court of Appeals got it wrong, too.
Okay. I apologize. But in any event, it's our position. And we've set forth this in a lot of detail in our brief. This issue, the Rebernick issue, was raised in the trial court. And the idea that raised in the Court of Appeals. And the idea that there was no opportunity for a hearing or they should be given by the, I mean, Acuity should be given a right to a hearing on the issue of whether the Stones would have bought this coverage was never raised until we get to the Supreme Court. Despite many, many opportunities to raise it, the Rebernick case was cited by us and used in a brief to Judge Foley 2 days after the Rebernick number one case, the Court of Appeals decision, was published.
So is your argument reformation or is your argument judicial estoppel?
With regard to, well, we're arguing that reformation is the appropriate remedy. We're also arguing...
We haven't had that determination at the trial court level yet, and that's why I asked the question. The trial court hasn't gone through the process of reforming the contract and determining whether or not that is an appropriate remedy. It seems to me that your argument is that, look, this was out there, we knew about it, in fact, it was litigated in the Court of Appeals early on as part of this process, and therefore, since the position of the parties was that, look, if the position of the Acuity was that if we lose, this is what we'll pay, that's what they're stuck with. That sounds to me to be a little bit different than reformation. That sounds to me to be a judicial estoppel. That's why I'm trying to pin you down as to what you're talking about.
I believe it is, in a way, a judicial estoppel argument because, as I've cited and attached to our supplemental appendix, Acuity represented to the Court of Appeals when they were determining whether they had jurisdiction to hear this appeal that there was, quote unquote, no chance that this case would get back to the trial court on any issues. In that case, and in that instance, I believe that the Acuity is judicially estopped from asserting now that they're entitled to a hearing on whether the Stones would have purchased this particular type of coverage. I do note as well, and the court knows this, that the Court of Appeals found as indicative that, as I interpreted, as indicative that the Stones would have bought this coverage, is they didn't, the Stones didn't buy your basic insurance policy. They had quite a bit of coverage. They had $300,000 of UIM coverage going into it.
I guess my question is, how would we know that? For example, I'm not sure that the record reflects what the maximum underlying UIM coverage was here in this case. Does the record reflect that?
What the maximum UIM coverage available?
That's correct.
Umbrella, I assume.
No. The basic, for example, if the basic maximum, I don't know if the basic maximum here is $300,000 or if the basic maximum is $500,000 or if the basic maximum is $1 million. And if the basic maximum is $500,000 and they purchased $300,000, then how do we know they would have purchased $1 million? Those are fact questions that I'm not sure are answered on the basis of this record.
You are correct. We do not know what the maximum amount is. That is a correct statement.
So it's hard to reform the contract because you don't know what to reform it to. You reform it to say, if you want, that they should have offered underinsured motorist coverage, but that's notice under the statute. But you don't know how much to buy. That's the problem. Well, so you have to fill that in some fashion. You can fill it in. It was waived because it wasn't fought out in the trial court. It was waived in the Court of Appeals. It's covered by the stipulation. If you don't like the label waiver, you might call it judicial estoppel. Or you have to do what Justice Butler said might have to be done. You send it back to the trial court and find out intent. I mean, saying it should be reformed doesn't help us.
Well,
I suggest.
Yeah, from a practical standpoint, I mean, if we look at what would happen if we get back to the trial court on an issue of would the Stones have purchased that? I mean, do we have a deposition of Vaughn and Christine Stone and ask them, well, would you have purchased this? What are they going to say? I
mean, how much are you offering? I'll buy it all.
Yeah. I mean, the evidence
it's
in the
hindsight.
The evidence isn't record as... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, the $500,000 mentioned in the stipulation, that's damages. What I don't understand is just what would the Stones get, assuming they had bought underinsured coverage, underinsured motorist coverage, in the personal umbrella? And how much would they have to buy to cover their damages?
In this case?
Yeah, in this case. I just don't, I don't know the numbers. I can't figure them out.
Well, to cover their damages in this case, well, to cover the,
they got a $500,000 already, didn't they?
Yes, from the underlying carrier.
Okay.
Not from, the underlying carrier, from the tortfeasor's carrier.
Tortfeasor. Okay, and they got $300,000 in their own motor vehicle case. And the question then is, do they get anything under that?
No.
No, because they're not. It's not an underinsured car, right?
Correct.
Okay.
You have to add on the $1 million.
That's right. So now you add on the personal umbrella. So the damages were $500,000. Why do they get anything? They've already been paid $500,000, right?
Well, we've determined by stipulation that their damages were a total of, it's exact, you know, $1,010,000. They actually
actually
received $10,000 from the individual person, Miss Lane.
So it's $1,010,000. They got $500,000. They're short $500,000. They're short $500,000, right?
That is correct.
And have they covered under the underinsured motorist coverage in the umbrella up to $1 million, then the tortfeasor is an underinsured motorist coverage.
That is correct.
So how much would they get from the company if they had bought the whole $1 million? They would get $500,000 roughly?
That is correct.
That's how the calculations are made.
$500,000 they've already $510,000 they've already received, and we've determined that by stipulation that they had the potential to, if what happened is we reached an agreement as to how, what the value of the claim
right.
was.
Okay.
We determined that value to be $1,010,000 basically. It could have gone up to $1 million, but $1 million plus the $500,000 they've already received. So $1,500,000. But we stipulated that if the Stones are successful on appeal, they would be entitled to $500,000 worth of coverage.
The problem is we don't know what successful on appeal means.
Well, I would say to that is that Rebernick was on the table when that stipulation was drawn. It was briefed with Judge Foley in the trial court in Milwaukee County, and it was argued before Judge Foley.
So you mean successful means that under the statute, you had, the insurance company had to give notice. Is that what you mean by successful?
Correct.
As I understand your position, there was ongoing insurance coverage for these folks. And by virtue of the fact that Acuity did not send a letter notifying them of the opportunity to acquire additional underinsured motorist coverage, the penalty for that, if we assume they goofed up, is that they should be just automatically permitted to buy $1 million worth of underinsured motorist coverage after the fact without a hearing, and then they'll get $500,000. I mean, isn't that a little over the top for the failure to send a letter?
Well, with all due respect, that's what reformation is about. If you do not give what the statute requires you give, meaning the notice in this case, the policy should be reformed to comply with the statute in exchange for a premium. They'd have to pay a premium for it. And then you get that coverage. I've cited several cases in which that has happened in this section 631.15 was utilized by the court to reform a policy and provide after-the-fact coverage. In fact, one of those cases, the Brunson case, which we cited, this court held, it's a 2001 case, this court held that Section 631.15 operates to the insurance company's detriment and that the policy is read to supply the higher level of coverage, although no premium was paid for it.
Why should we assume that if they had gotten the notice, they would have purchased more than three times what they had carried for years and years and years?
They would have, I think, under the facts of this case, under this record, since they already had a $1 million umbrella policy, I would suggest, and I don't know the exact cost, although I'll leave it at that because there was a motion brought before the court to supplement the record. But I would suggest that they would have paid the additional premium. They already had the $1 million umbrella coverage. They would have paid the additional premium, had they been provided notice, to tack on or add on the UIM coverage to that.
Is the premium different if you buy more underinsured motorist coverage in an auto policy than if you buy it under the personal umbrella policy?
My understanding of a personal umbrella policy is that because it only kicks in certain instances, in the catastrophic loss type of cases, that the premiums generally for those are less.
Do the insurance industry generally give the umbrella and excess carriers to reinsurers?
To reinsurers?
Yes.
I don't know the answer to that question. I apologize. Maybe Mr. Simpson would know the answer to that since he represents insurance companies more often. I also wanted to briefly point out the case that we cited to this court dealing with it's the Tribble case, Tribble versus Tower Insurance Company. We cited it in our brief. It's a case, and this addresses the argument made by the defense Acuity that the position that we're stating had not been pled. And in that particular case, this court held that reformation was allowed on appeal even though the issue had not been raised by the pleadings parties or the trial court. I think that's an important decision, an important point in this case as in response to the argument that this particular remedy had not been pled by us.
Counselor, do you know if there's anything in the legislative history that would let us determine whether the purpose of the notice, the statutory notice, was to simply educate people about what UIM, underinsured motorist coverage, is as compared with liability coverage? Or was there some broader purpose behind the statute? Is there anything in the legislative history that you know of about that?
I do not. I do note that this court commented in the Rebernick case that the legislative history on 632.32.4M was sparse, is the words of this court. However, the court did analyze the statute and the legislative history that was available and indicated at paragraph 24 that the final version of the Act states that its purpose in relevant part relates simply to notification of the availability of underinsured motorist coverage. And the court stated in paragraph 25 of the Rebernick decision what I consider to be very poignant and powerful words in terms of the facts of our case. My red light is on.
You may finish your sentence.
Okay. from both the language of the statute and the sparse legislative history, it is thus evident that a central purpose of 632.32(4)M is to ensure that all insureds know of the availability of UIM coverage. Put another way, the legislature has determined that where UIM coverage is available, insureds should know about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. Mr. Sampson.
I agree that insureds should know about it, and these insureds did know about it. One quick comment before I go right to reformation and judicial estoppel issues, as Justice Prosser suggested, and I certainly agree we need to address, I need to address that. If you look at page 195 of the record, I do not see anything in there that there was some separate notice that was sent out to new policyholders. What it says in here is that a new question was added to the application to ask if it was desired. And that's in the bottom, the last bullet point on 195. That's all I wanted to do with the record. The other comment relates to the remedy, and that's at page 68 of the record, where it indicates the parties agreed that the $500,000 figure would be the amount Acuity would pay for injuries and damages sustained by the Stones in the event insurance coverage is found on appeal. And that's the operative phrase there. In terms of the remedy,
oops. Counsel, before you move to the remedy, I did have a question that I asked of Mr. Lonzo that I said I was going to indicate or ask of you as well.
That's correct.
And that dealt with the policy declarations page where it includes dwelling endorsements. This is Appendix 140. And it includes a number of different vehicles, the Subaru Forester, the Mercury Cougar, the S10, the pop-up camper, the travel trailer. As well as, now, when I look at that, and I know how my insurance policies work, and I have two automobiles, and I have an insurance policy for each automobile. I have homeowner's insurance. They're all with the same company. That's a separate policy. I guess my question to you, based on this declaration page, that dwelling and those different vehicles, is that all part of one policy, or are those separate policies?
In this case, this is one policy. It's one document. It happens to provide some of the carriers have gone to a policy where they give you a deal if you have your homeowners and your auto and your umbrella, you have everything together. And they put it in one policy, and that's what was done here. It's one policy. If you accept the argument, getting back to what I started with, that somehow there's more than one policy here, every endorsement's a policy. We have 10, 11, 12 policies here. We've got a fungi endorsement here. That's a policy.
Come on. You know,
No.
There were a couple of cases regarding insurance last year. You know, Rebernick is one. Rocker is another. Now, Rocker involved, what did Rocker involve? Rocker involved a comprehensive general liability policy. Now, if you want, you can say, oh, from now on, we're going to call that an endorsement. But it's a CGL is a policy. Rocker involved a commercial umbrella policy. You can call it an endorsement. And if you call it an endorsement, just look at WSSTAT 600.0335, which says the definition of policies include endorsement.
Sure.
But, you know, you have personal umbrella policies. You have, your auto policy. Then you have coverages. You have coverages are UM, UIM, you know, MedPay is a coverage. What's bothersome to me is it seems like you're, even in view of the statute where endorsements are policies in the definition, I don't want to suggest, because I think there's goodwill. I don't mean that anyone's playing games, but come on. A CGL is a policy. It's not an endorsement. Commercial umbrella is a policy. It's not an endorsement. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but, I mean, have you...
You were on the second part there.
That commercial umbrella is a policy, not an... And well, I think Rocker treated it as a policy. Is Rocker wrong in that regard then?
Well, that's certainly what the insurance commissioner commented in their interpretation of it.
I know they thought Rocker was wrong, you know, and I know that you think that Rebernick is wrong, but Rocker treated a commercial umbrella policy, not as coverage or endorsement, you know, and the court was 7-0 with regard to this issue.
My response to that is, how are you going to magically bless some documents? An endorsement is really a policy, but when we talk about fungi, it really is an endorsement. We were just kidding about that. How are you supposed to draw some line and separate that? And then you have
fungi and what? Homeowners policy you're talking about?
It says in here
this
fungi
policy, and it's not an
endorsement.
endorsement to the personal umbrella, or maybe it's an endorsement to the motor vehicle.
There might have to be an exception in the law on fungi, but other than that.
Well, there's a lot of endorsements and a lot of policies.
If you could address, I know your red light is on, but Justice Prosser asked you to address remedy and reformation, if you could do that.
But let me just try to.
Want to focus me here?
Try to pinpoint the question. For the sake of argument, suppose the court finds that there should have been a notice. What rational remedy exists for a violation of the notice standard other than the kind of reformation that counsel is seeking?
Well, the first hurdle there is, we are entitled to a hearing as to whether these people would have even bought the insurance had that notice been sent. The Rebernick case at the trial court level, the majority had ruled they had notice of the $300,000 of insurance or $200,000 in Rebernick. What's the difference with all this? The trial court had said, we're not going to consider a Rebernick issue. The policy is contextually ambiguous. We'll have a trial with liability and damages. And that's what the stipulation involved. We avoided having to go through a 4-day trial and each side bringing in experts and spending time to determine damages. There was no discussion of this, maybe this Rebernick theory is going to blossom after the trial court decision. We never had a chance to be heard on that one way or the other. In terms of a viable remedy, I don't know why there should necessarily be a remedy with respect to this. There are statutes passed that where the people are, it's recommended people do things are people supposed to do things. This is a statute that's not one where an insurance carrier might be trying to limit coverage beyond what the legislature says they can do, like we had a few years back with UM coverage cases, and the policies were reformed to reflect what the legislature said you do. This is a statute that basically encourages insurance companies to go out and provide notice about this availability of UM coverage. I don't believe that if the legislature wanted to put a penalty provision in here, they could have. I don't believe there should be a penalty with respect to this. It's just a statute that encourages you to use your marketing machine to let people know, hey, this is a new kind of coverage. It's been around about 10 years. Instead of saying, the legislature could have said, ye shall provide underinsured motorist coverage of $1 million, just to pick a number. And if they'd said that, then God bless this court. When Acuity had $300,000, you should have reformed it to make it $1 million. But the legislature didn't do that. They said send out some notice. They sent out the best notice they could. That does not mean that there's a penalty that's attached to that.
Justice Butler.
If I might. I understand that you're arguing for no penalty at all if the court finds lack of notice. But your fallback position was, and I note that there appears to have been an epiphany between your brief in chief and your reply brief, and I can suspect where that epiphany came from. But with respect to the reformation issue, how do you get around the satellite litigation that took place in the Court of Appeals as to whether or not there was going to be anything to go back if the Court of Appeals ruled against you?
Well, when that statement was made with respect to that, Rebernick was not yet decided by the state Supreme Court. All we had is one Court of Appeals decision where they had said, well, you know, the guy had UIM coverage. He's got enough notice there. What's the difference? There was a dissenting opinion, I believe, from Judge Kessler that was more aggressive at that point. What I thought was very unfair about this whole thing was to say that we had to go back and have a 4-day trial over what the damages were here. And I wasn't intending on ever going back and having a trial about liability and damages. I had no idea that we were going to come up with this new theory and then somehow we were going to be saddled with the proposition that, gee, this comment about success on the appeal or that would foreclose us on all issues with respect to a new theory of liability that was invented.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Simpson. And thank you, Mr. Alonzo, for your arguments. in yet another UIM case, of which we've had several over the past few years. That concludes our hearing in 05-AP-1629, G. Vaughan Stone et al. Versus Acuity. Justice Butler will be out very shortly to meet with the students and the coalition and anyone else who wishes to meet with him. The court will then have lunch, but the court will be back in the conference room at 1:10. Short lunch for a closed conference on our next case. We are in recess.